on WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, February 3rd. It's the dry season and drought on top of that. Brush fires in South Sarasota County yesterday afternoon shut down part of I-75 for a couple hours, wreaking havoc on traffic. The northbound lanes of the Interstate Highway near the Kings Highway interchange in Northport were blocked as commuters watched smoke blowing from a 5-acre brush fire near North Yorkshire Boulevard and Blue Leaf Drive. No homes were threatened. Northport firefighters also battled a 1/2-acre brush fire off Sumter Avenue. It's Sarasota's most controversial road project, and tomorrow the county will host an information meeting to share details about the Manasota Beach Road extension. This is a project pushed by developer Pat Neal that would connect the fast-growing Welland Park development with Englewood and the beaches on Manasota Key. From 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, you can learn about the design and next steps at the Robert L. Anderson Administration Center in Venice. The address, 4000 South Tamiami Trail. At 6:30, a presentation will begin in the County Commission chambers. The Florida Department of State announced yesterday that no citizen initiatives have turned in enough verified signatures to appear on the 2026 ballot. That includes the ballot measure that would legalize recreational marijuana. But the organizers behind that initiative beg to differ. They say it was too early to determine, and they may have reached the 880,000 required signatures. The dispute may end up in court. The Florida Attorney General escalated a long simmering fight with a Republican legislator. At a press conference in Tampa yesterday, James Uthmeyer called for the ouster of State Representative Alex Andrade from a House committee because of his ties to a law firm that defends Planned Parenthood in a lawsuit brought by the state. Uthmeyer said he will not cooperate with the House Healthcare Budget Subcommittee as long as Andrade is its chairman. Andrade, who represents a district in the Panhandle, led an investigation into the charity run by Governor Ron DeSantis' wife. Andrade says the attorney general committed fraud. A grand jury has been investigating the Hope Florida Foundation since October. As of this week, no indictment has been returned. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, February 3rd.
No, I mean, like, I don't see any document.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 79 of Our Changing Environment. The previous show was Melody Matrix, hosted by Neil.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and this show is being recorded and broadcast on February 3rd, 2026.
Today, we're going to be talking with the executive director of Suncoast Waterkeeper, Dr. Abby Turna, about waterkeeper, water quality, and the recently proposed cruise port in Manatee County.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
What is Suncoast Waterkeeper, and how long has it been around, and what is its mission?
So Suncoast Waterkeeper is a small but mighty nonprofit working to protect our local waters, and we've been around since 2012. And our mission, like I said, is to protect our local waters, so you can really boil down what we do into three words. We monitor, we inform, and then we act. So we monitor the environment. We do water quality monitoring each week for harmful bacteria, each month for nitrogen, which fuels harmful algal blooms. And then we also do things like PFAS testing in people's drinking water. We monitor mangroves, and we do we collect pollution reports. So we monitor all of that, and then we inform people of the results. And then depending on what needs to be done, we act. So we act in all sorts of ways, whether that's showing up to county or city council meetings, whether that's showing up to the state legislature or putting out calls to action, or when all else fails, we also are able to sue polluters under the Clean Water Act.
Wow. So there are other waterkeeper entities, right? There's the Tampa Bay Waterkeeper?
Yeah, so there's 15 entities throughout the state, and there's 360 throughout the globe. So it's a global movement.
And is there one to the south of us here?
The one closest to the south is Coosa Waterkeeper.
Okay, great.
And the Coosahatchee is really their watershed.
All right.
So tell us about your water monitoring program.
Yeah, sure. So like I was mentioning, each week we monitor enterococci bacteria. So we model our program after the Department of Health Department of Health's Healthy Beaches program. And so each week they monitor the Gulfside beaches. In 2011, they were able to monitor a lot more bayside locations, but after funding cuts, they weren't able to, and they focused their resources on the beach, which makes a lot of sense since we have so many visitors to our lovely beaches. So we're filling that gap by going out to 17 bayside locations from the Manatee River all the way down to Lemon Bay and monitoring them for enterococci, and then posting those results on our website and also on social media. We've been doing this for years, and what we are learning is that there are regular occurrence of high bacteria moving into our waters. And so now we're working with the University of South Florida to do some microbial source tracking or looking at the DNA in the bacteria concentration so we can understand where that pollution is coming from. And then each month we monitor for nitrogen, all different kinds of nitrogen species, because nitrogen fuels harmful algal blooms. And it's one of the nutrients that people are most concerned about. So we monitor about 11 locations throughout the Suncoast and report those to different local agencies and then also to the state. I should mention that we also report our enterococci bacteria testing to the state, which is used then to determine whether or not a water body is meeting state water quality criteria. And then we're also doing per- and polyfluoroalkyline substances, or PFAS testing. Those are the forever chemicals. People most notably know them as the chemicals on Teflon, but they're in just about everything from pizza boxes to popcorn bags to your dental floss, shampoo, and all of your probably makeup. And so we monitor drinking water. And we started in Northport, and now we're moving to the city of Bradenton. What we're finding is that surface water sources, when you get your drinking water from surface water sources, you're more likely to have PFAS in your drinking water than if you get it from a groundwater source. So that's just for our area. It's different throughout the state of Florida.
So let's go back. You know, we worked for decades at Caples on the New College campus, and you test at the Caples Beach.
Yeah, we do.
And so your website suggests that only 2/3 of the time is the water there suitable in terms of the bacteria levels.
Yes.
So we have a waterfront program. We have boats and kayaks, and kids wade out into the bay there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if a New College understands what's going on there.
Well, so I don't know whether or not they understand, but I do know that we are very interested in learning more about what are the sources of bacteria in that area. We do believe that we have some preliminary results that showcase that it could be birds. And so you can't really do anything about birds except for just be aware that birds are there and they're, you know, droppings into the water. And so, you know, don't go swimming when you have any open cuts and try not to get it in your mouth. But
So
we're hoping to do microbial source tracking there. You know, when I say microbial source tracking, it's like a $10,000 at minimum investigation. So if we wanted to investigate Caples, it would be a $10,000 investigation. And that is really costly. So we're starting with Longboat Key, because Longboat Key Council men and women, or commissioners, I'm not sure what they're called, but they are very interested in knowing the results because they're interested in fixing the problem. So that's where we're starting, because we think that's a good investment.
Yeah, and there's other bay sites. Indian Beach, where a lot of people, that was heavily impacted by the storms, but that's a popular spot. And then the bay, as it's called, the Bay Park, they put in a beach of sorts down there.
Yes. The bay has a beach. They claim, though, that you're not allowed to swim there, but there are no swimming signs. So we've been asking for no swimming signs if, indeed, you can't swim there. There's no one monitoring whether or not you swim there, and we're finding that the water quality can be just as poor there as any place else. Indian Beach, we know that there's a problem there. There's a stormwater pipe that's been broken out there for quite some time, and so they are fixing that stormwater pipe. I don't know if they're going to be doing any additional upgrades to the system, but stormwater is definitely the influential factor on Indian Beach. So if you're worried about water quality, just stay out 24 hours after a rain event.
So, Julie, maybe you could talk about the NOAA grant that we got at New College that looked at the stormwater in the Indian Beach Sapphire Shores neighborhood.
Yeah, so we got a NOAA grant maybe in the 1990s.
Sounds about right.
And we mapped all of the outlets in the Indian Beach Sapphire Shore neighborhood, and then we monitored all of the inlets to the bay there.
It wasn't monitoring so much as mapping. The sort of micro watershed. So
right.
we were in a position, we didn't get additional funding, but we were in a position to go to each house with a map and say, the rain that falls on your house and driveway comes out of this pipe, and then we give them a photograph of the pipe. they're like their personal watershed pipe that was discharging into the bay. And we thought that would be a great awareness builder if people understood the relationship between their roof, their driveway, their lawn maintenance practices, their dog, and a particular identifiable pipe. I guess it would have been fun to put labels on the pipes, so if people walked up and down the shoreline, they could they could see the name of the little watershed. But yeah, that's a very problem. That whole New College South area is problematic, at least till 10th Street, I would say, because the shore there is relatively high, and it was developed relatively early, so there was no real stormwater forethought given. So the water that does fall in that neighborhood west of Trail enters the bay pretty rapidly.
Yes.
And it doesn't have any stormwater treatment.
Right.
It just goes impervious surface to pipes and into the bay.
Exactly. Which you could see would be a problem, especially if we're talking about swimming in the bay.
So the health of New College students is getting to be an issue. You know who we should have on the show is Ruth Follett.
Yeah, that's right.
She's been doing research about air quality relative to the airport in relation to New College athletes. You know, we now have a lot of strenuous outdoor sports, beach volleyball and soccer and lacrosse, and baseball is supposed to be coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're exercising strenuously, breathing in air related to what's coming off the airport, that's not a good health situation.
Yeah, so we have students at Booker High School that's also investigating air quality and really the overlap of air quality, extreme heat, and the poor drinking water quality in their schools. And it's not like the drinking water quality doesn't meet or exceed all Safe Drinking Water Act standards, because it does, but kids just don't want to drink it. It just tastes bad. Like, it smells bad, it tastes bad. And so they're trying to figure out, why does it smell bad and taste bad? And, like, what can we do to improve the water quality so that kids want to drink it? Because when you couple that with extreme heat and then poor air quality, you can see how that could become a recipe for harm to students, especially athletes. And so in April, unfortunately, in 2025, a student who had an extended PE period due to testing unfortunately succumbed to dehydration potentially and died on the soccer field at school. And that is terrible, but the students there understood that they don't want this to happen again, and they want to figure out how they can help. And what we found from our air quality results is that the students monitored with a homemade monitor, particulate matter 5. So it's 5 microns in size. And generally, regulators look at 2.5 and 10. So we were looking at something in between because it's what we could do with our limited budget. So they're looking at particulate matter 5. And When you look at the air quality criteria, it fell into the moderate range. But I think that students deserve to have good air quality. And even though it's moderate and not poor, I don't think that the student should look at that as though that's okay, because who decides what's moderate and who decides what's good and what's poor, and what population is that decided for? And then how does that overlap with extreme heat, and what kind of role does this moderate air quality play? But more importantly, now we're investigating what is in that particular matter five, because what is in it is going to determine if it's really moderate or if it's really harmful. And so a professor at UC Davis is investigating what's on the filters that they collected.
That's great. I know from experience that taste is a really important factor in water. Julie and I stayed at a place I think was probably pretty expensive, and they would pack a lunch for you to take out to the beach. But the lemonade was made from concentrate, and the water they used was sulfur water.
Ooh.
So you had this great picnic on the beach, but you had to pinch your nose closed in order to drink the lemonade.
Exactly. So, yeah, taste is important. And so they actually, the students investigated those, I guess they're called primary drinking water standards, which, or secondary, I forget which ones, but basically it's taste and odor compounds. So they investigated the taste and odor compounds. They had a blind taste test to figure out which waters they might like the best. And they could pick out their school water like no problem, which was really interesting, we thought.
That's school spirit when you can identify your, what's coming out of the drinking fountain.
For sure.
Okay.
So Suncoast Waterkeeper is also monitoring legislative bills.
Yes.
And so there's two bills that your latest newsletter focuses on.
Mm-hmm.
And one is HB 479. And Senate Bill 718.
Yeah, so this bill, well, so first of all, both of them don't look like each other, and I don't remember which one is which. There's so many bills right now that we're tracking, it's hard to keep like track of their numbers in your head. But basically, the one component of the bill is like extremely bad, and it is an overreach of preemption, where it preempts government, local governments, from doing anything related to water quality protection, period, point blank. The other bill softened a little bit and got rid of all of the bad stuff, but kept preemption over wetland protections and wetland buffer protections, which is something that we in Manatee County don't want to see. We know that residents really are into wetlands and wetland buffers and understand their importance to water quality and flood control and wildlife habitat. So I know that one commissioner in Manatee County, Commissioner Cruz, has been working really hard to overturn SB
180.
Thank you, 180.
Yeah,
I almost said 280. Just so that they can bring back their wetland protections. And so this bill would be another layer to add to their, you know, their struggle to bring back their comprehensive plan.
Yeah, preemption is just a terrible long-term trend that's getting worse, where the state government wants to regulate everything at the local level. There's some preemption that probably makes sense, like with game laws. If you had a different, if you could kill three deer in one county and one deer in the next county, it'd be hard to prove, you know, where the deer came from. So there's some argument for consistency across counties, but a lot of what they've done recently are just crazy, heavy-handed manipulation from Tallahassee that prevents local governments. And, of course, so local governments that have the ability to change things. So I testified, you may have, I don't recall, at the local legislative delegation meetings. And so there's a lot of concern there about this limiting property tax. And part of my testimony was local commissioners can control property tax. They set the millage rate. What they can't do is deal with insurance costs. So if Tallahassee wanted to really do something to help homeowners that that can't be done at the local level, they should be working on insurance, not on what the what the local ad valorem tax rate's going to be.
Yeah, I get asked a lot, what is the one thing that keeps you up at night, or what is the one thing that if we could change, that we could change for the better for water quality throughout the state? And I always say it's the state legislature. Like, change them. Because every year we're tracking a multitude of bad bills, and every year the preemption gets worse. And so that is the thing that we really need to look at. If people are sitting at home wondering what they can do to better the state of Florida's water quality, it's look at your local legislature, like your actual representative or state senator, and look at what they're doing and contact them and tell them about this bill and other bills that are coming down the pipe that do not serve Floridians.
Yeah. Yeah, that's HB 479 and Senate Bill 718.
So there's also something in your Suncoast Waterkeeper newsletter about Manatee County's drinking water supply.
Yeah. So Manatee County just recently, the staff did a report in front of the commission that noted that they needed to find additional water resources by a certain date, and that they were going to have a deficit. And, you know, what I think that Manatee County really needs to think about is how they're currently using their water. If you look at the 2024 water use report from Swift Mud, you will find that Manatee County has a really high sports field and golf water budget, meaning that, so if you take all of the public supply that they send out to their hundreds of thousands of residents, 23% of that is being pulled out of the ground, or mostly pulled out of the ground, but they're also using some surface water to irrigate their golf courses and also their sports fields. It is the biggest water budget for this use in all of Swift Mud's district. And I don't think there's the complete recognition that groundwater and surface water are intimately connected, especially when we're talking about irrigation, because usually you irrigate with shallow groundwater, which is basically the same thing that's in Lake Manatee. So I think that I heard a news reporter say that staff was grateful, and I don't know if this is true, but they were grateful that the new developments out east will all be on well water, so there wouldn't be that lift on the potable water supply, but not recognizing that these developments are all in the headwaters of Lake Manatee. So if they're putting straws in the aquifer, then there's going to be less water moving to Lake Manatee, which will then reduce the supply in general. Furthermore, I just want to add that there's very little reclaimed water used in Manatee County. There's so much opportunity for reclaimed water in Manatee County that they could really reduce their demand by increasing reclaimed water for irrigation throughout the county.
Yeah.
And so the water demand is expected to rise by 13%. Increasing roughly from 48 million gallons per day to 54 million gallons per day. And this increase is not inevitable. It's a wake-up signal signaling that current policies are pushing the county toward a shortage that can still be prevented with smarter planning and stronger protections. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the whole thing, too, is the wetland protections. You know, many wetlands are intimately connected. I mean, they all are to shallow groundwater, some of them to deeper groundwater, but regardless, protecting these recharge areas, protecting the headwaters, especially the headwater wetlands and the buffer zones, there are developments where these headwater streams, there is no protection of their buffer. So developments can develop right to the stream's edge. That is not protective of water, the water supply, water resources, water quality at all. And so, yeah, we could do better at protecting, and then we can reuse water more effectively.
Now, an interesting connection between the water quality the students were experiencing and this question. So all of the water that goes to homes is treated to potable water quality standards. But if people are unwilling to drink it, then it's sort of overkill. A lot of the water that we use does not need to be so highly treated.
Right, for irrigation.
Yeah, it could be for irrigation. And we could cut way back on irrigation as well. You know, if you drive up and down the interstate and look at the median, you never see sprinklers going, right? And yet the grass is growing in those medians. They have to mow it frequently. So the notion that we have to irrigate grass in Sarasota, not necessarily the case. So if we could cut back on, I guess I've heard it's like half the water that's used is used for irrigation. So if we could cut back significantly on that, we could accommodate more people without having to develop new water sources. And I had actually proposed to the Peace River Water Authority, or whatever it's called, they should be investigating paying people. If it's cheaper to pay people not to use water than to develop a new source, then maybe we should be looking at historic records of water consumption and saying, look, if you'll cut it back to using half, we'll stroke you a check. You could go visit your kids in Omaha or whatever. And we won't have to drill wells. We won't have to lay pipe. We won't have to build water treatment facilities. We won't have to send it to your house, and we won't have to treat it. So we could save a lot of money if we could just persuade people either out of their goodwill or out of their pocketbook to use less water.
Yeah, for sure. In Manatee County's use rate is 100 gallons per person, which is
crazy.
Per day, which it is crazy. That's a really high amount and yeah. Can be really reduced.
Right.
Sarasota County's is 88. And you know, water loss is high in both counties, though.
Yeah.
They have a total water loss around 9% of their total treated supply.
Yeah.
Imagine what that 9% could do if it was going to the consumer instead of being lost in the treatment process. And usually it's lost through dead-end neighborhoods where the pipe dead-ends and there's no looping, so they have to flush the water. So if you've ever seen a hydrant just spilling out at night, that's flushing to keep the water in the pipes, having the right chlorine residual so that the bacteria doesn't grow. And so, yeah, they can flush up to 10% before they get an audit from Swift Mud.
So you said earlier that surface water has way more PFAS than groundwater. And so how does that affect the water quality? How much surface water is in the mix for Manatee County versus groundwater?
Yeah, so in Manatee County, it's primarily surface water. It's like 90-something percent surface water, and then there's a small amount of groundwater that's being mixed in. Same with Sarasota County. It's majority surface water, although they do use a little bit of more groundwater. But the cities, City of Sarasota, they use majority groundwater, and I don't think any surface water. And then City of Bradenton uses all surface water, maybe a little bit of groundwater. But what we're finding is that the groundwater, especially like in the city of Venice, city in Sarasota, that the groundwater is from like the intermediate aquifer, and that is really regional and cut off by a clay layer, which doesn't allow for percolation from up top. Now, that's not 100% accurate throughout the spring sheds or through the groundwater shed, however you want to call it. But for the most part, the connection opportunities are limited compared to surface water or shallow groundwater, where that connection is distributed throughout the entire watershed. So because of that, there's a little bit more protection coming in from the intermediate aquifer, and we're seeing that in our PFAS tests, whether we send the tests to Cyclopure or to University of Florida for investigation. But that's really unique to our region and doesn't exist throughout the state of Florida. So like in Tallahassee, where the groundwater and surface water are more intimately connected, you can see PFAS in drinking water wells. Same when you move down south, where the groundwater and the surface water are more intimately connected.
And you were specifically looking at Northport, which I imagine is the vast majority is surface water, right?
Yeah, so they get it from the Miakahatchee Creek,
yeah.
And there's a heavily suburbanized heart of that creek right before they pump it out. And that's why we were interested in looking there first. Also because University of Florida, our preliminary tests showed that they had the highest amount of PFAS in our area. But then also when you look at the average was well above the state average. And so we wanted to dive in deeper. And what we found was what we had originally found in 2023. There was really no change in the total amount of PFAS or the PFAS that we were finding. What we're finding is like a total high level of PFAS in the 7 to 12 parts per trillion range. And you might think that's pretty small. That's like 7 to 12 drops in, I don't know, like 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. But what people have found is that it only takes one drop or even less than a drop for it to be harmful to your body. So these things are really strong, and they build up in your bodies and build up in the environment. That's why they're called forever chemicals, because they don't break down. And so when you get, you know, just a few drops, it builds up over time and can cause havoc.
Oh, so maybe Northport's going to have to change the location of their water intake and move it further upstream. So.
Well, they meet and exceed all Safe Drinking Water Act standards, so nothing's going to be done until those Safe Drinking Water Act standards change. And the change has been pushed back by the federal government till 2028, 2029. The change has also been watered down a bit, and it does not monitor the PFAS that we're finding in the city of Northport. So what we're finding throughout the state of Florida is that there are different PFAS that are affecting the state than are affecting the nation. And many of those PFAS that are found a lot throughout the state are not a part of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. So the state would really need to have its own Safe Drinking Water Act to regulate the PFAS that we're finding at high levels in the state of Florida. And then even more specifically, regionally, we're finding a little bit different mixture of PFAS in like the city of Northport versus the city of Bradenton. And so what are local municipalities going to do? We're unsure. But I would say one thing is clear is that we should not be drinking our wastewater, because that is also an option on the table since rules passed recently and then were implemented in February of 2025.
And you're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and BPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I want to introduce our guest. Today we're talking with Executive Director of Suncoast Waterkeeper, Dr. Abby Turna, about waterkeeper water quality and recently proposed cruise port. The city of Sarasota is implementing a new school zone camera safety program to help keep children safe. The program enforces speed limits in school zones at all times during the school day, even when lights aren't flashing. Drivers exceeding the limit by over 10 miles per hour face fines. More information is available at sarasotaflorida.gov or by calling 941-487-0022.
And if I recall correctly, the Trump administration just legalized PFAS-related agricultural products.
Oh, I'm not aware of that.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah. And Julie and I, we did some sampling out at Myakka Park and elsewhere on the Myakka River for PFAS, right?
Yeah, we did. And this was done by a professor at the University of Florida. And he was trying to create a map of PFAS for the whole state of Florida by sampling surface waters.
Yeah.
So that was Bowden.
Yeah, that was Bowden.
He has created that map, and it's really good. And actually, he's the one that helped us with our preliminary drinking water results. And then we dug deeper using Cyclopure.
So let's talk about the proposed cruise port west of the Sunshine Skyway.
Yeah, so this is a horrible idea to put in a cruise port in the middle of a aquatic preserve. Mm-hmm. And so while the private land holdings are essentially not a part of the aquatic preserve, they're surrounded by the waters and the land within the aquatic preserve. So it's one of those things that is really hard to communicate. Yes, it's in the aquatic preserve, and that's a problem because the aquatic preserve has higher levels of protection afforded to it because it was set aside by the state as an outstanding Florida resource, and it's supposed to be protected for future generations.
So the rationale for all this is that the current ports that could service vessels are limited by the height of the Sunshine Skyway, and some of the newer, bigger, giant cruise ships that have, like, what, 3,000 people?
I think 7,000.
7,000. Mm-hmm. They can't fit under the Skyway. So the options, you have three options. Either just deal with it and run smaller cruise vessels under the Skyway, raise the Skyway, or find some new place west of the Skyway where the boats don't have to go under. And so this is the option of finding a new place so that the vessels wouldn't have to go under the Skyway.
Yeah, I think this is just greed. This is what greed looks like, and it's not like the Port of Tampa is hurting for cruise passengers because it continues to grow year over year, and Tampa Bay Times did a great article on that growth. It's not like the Port of Manatee is hurting at all either because it also has revenue growth and is focused on transportation, which if you look at state statistics, transportation and cargo does way better than cruise cargo.
Yeah.
So we're in the right arena for economic growth. This doesn't bring economic growth. Unfortunately, it would limit and squash the economic potential that we currently have.
Well, and the thing I find amusing, I mean, when you get to Tampa, if Tampa was a stop on your cruise, at least you would be in Tampa. But if you stop at the entrance to the Skyway and disembark, you're in Teresia. So what are you going to do? With the exception of the place that sells orange juice and the Mardi Gras and Bastille Day on Teresia, there's not a lot happening there. In fact, the people who live on Teresia are probably 98% there because there isn't a lot happening there.
Exactly.
So the idea of, okay, folks, where you have a shore leave for a day to experience what's to offer here is just crazy. It would take you an hour probably to get to Tampa or somewhere interesting. So it seems like it could only really be used for people to leave, in which case basically you would need a big parking lot.
Yeah.
And the other problem is these vessels draw like 30 feet or more.
Yeah, actually the Port of Manatee just had to, I'm sorry, I said the wrong word. Sorry, the Port of Miami had to widen and deepen their channels in order to fit these mega ships, and it was to 50 feet.
Yeah.
And so right now the area is between 3 and 5 feet mostly,
right,
and no more than 18 feet.
Yeah.
And so that would be quite a change in depth. They also found in the Port of Miami that there was, or the Port of Everglades, they're really right next to each other, but through the cruise expand, or not cruise, but through the dredging expansion, materials smothered a lot of staghorn corals, but not just smothered them. What they found was that it was either smothering and or because there was all these toxins in the sediment that were locked in by organic matter that was then dissolved and circulated around, that the heavy metals were able to transverse, like travel far distances, much farther than they thought, and it ended up going up to 6 miles.
Mm.
And that those toxins were found to be what killed many of the corals in the area. And so there was huge coral loss because of the redistribution of these heavy metals. But then the sediments actually traveled 6 miles too. So what we're doing is we're putting together a map to show what it would look like if sediments were traveling 6 miles from the proposed dredge channel, because what you'll see is that is a lot of seagrass that gets smothered, and the seagrasses are extremely important to our area and think about the millions and millions of dollars and all the time and resources we've put into protecting seagrasses and making sure seagrasses grow back to the reference period, all to lose those gains because of, well, like I said, greed.
Yeah. Yeah. If any of our listeners have canoed or kayaked in that area, you know, if you flip your boat, the first rule is stand up.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's not shallow. A very deep system. And a lot of, if you look online, at least one of the maps depicting the area that would be involved in this cruise terminal involves property that isn't even owned by the people that are proposing the work. Some of it's owned by FDOT. So I think between the trustees of the Internal Improvement Fund in Tallahassee and SWIFMUD and FDOT, they're going to have a lot to say about whether this could even be considered.
Yeah, I guess we will have to see how that plays a role. I think it, you know, what's important to realize is that while the company says that they'll bring jobs to this area and economic growth, right now there are a lot of jobs that are on the line, specifically through commercial and recreational fishing. The commercial fishery brings in lots of revenue, and I actually had a number, but now I can't find it. So I will talk about the recreational fishery, which is valued at an estimated $1.5 billion and has thousands of jobs. So that's really important to think, like, how will those recreational fishermen be impacted, especially if the seagrass beds, which are the foundation of fishing, and mangroves, which are also really important to fishing, are devastated by this cruise port.
Yeah, it's a really special area. If you haven't had a chance to experience it, I can't tell you to do it, but it's an interesting spot. We enjoy paddling around there.
Yes, yeah, so there's a lot of hard bottom
yes.
there, and that's important for adult tarpon to spawn.
Yeah, tarpon. I think the bonefish and tarpon people are on the case.
They are.
Yeah.
They are.
Yes.
Yeah,
so that quote of the $1.5 billion was from Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, and they are on the case. And yes, yeah, so we are putting together a white paper where we talk about the impacts to these resources, especially the seagrasses and the hard bottom. So the hard bottom, there is 4.5 acres just within that Nat Cowan track, which is the proposed developed track. And there's way more, but it's unquantifiable at this point, and within the Terracea Aquatic Preserve that would be hurt. But hard bottom substrates are communities that can easily be destroyed, as you know, through any kind of sedimentation. So when we talk about the dispersal of sediment ruining the area and seagrasses, they will also ruin the hard bottom by being smothered.
If you're planning to simplify your life, you can start by giving yourself more space. Donate that unwanted vehicle you no longer need to WSLR. We'll have it picked up at no cost to you. Use the proceeds to help present your favorite programs here at WSLR and Fogartyville. More information is available at WSLR.org/donate-your-vehicle.
So, what else would you like to talk about regarding Suncoast Waterkeeper?
Well, so we have a petition. Nope, can't talk about that. Well, well, we're tracking this cruise port very closely, putting in records requests so that we can stay on top of the actions that are happening at local government and state government and federal government. So there's going to be three layers of permitting that's needed in order to get this cruise port off the ground. And so it's important to be vigilant and understand how this is going to happen. Suncoast Waterkeeper doesn't do anything alone. We do it in concert with all kinds of groups. So it just depends on the issue. But this particular cruise port issue, we're working with 12 other environmental groups that are mostly regional groups, so very local groups that are working together to bring information to the public about this issue and so that they can definitely stay informed and stay involved. And so we work collaboratively with groups across the state. So we monitor the state legislature. We get together every week as Waterkeepers Florida to do that monitoring. We divide and conquer. And, you know, like I was saying, when we work with the Booker High Group, we have a lot of different partners with that too. Foundations have supported that work. And then the Multicultural Health Institute is a partner in that program. And so everything we do is in collaboration with others, because you can't fix or protect water quality alone.
What is equitable access to waterways? I saw that on your website. What's that about?
Yeah, so that really sprung out of MLK Park. So MLK Park in Sarasota is actually the only county park in all of Sarasota County where there isn't access to the water, that there's fenced. The waterway is fenced.
Oh.
It's literally the only Sarasota County park where the waterway is fenced. And so in a black community with a fence, we believe that's not equitable access. So one of the things that we have done is worked with partners to survey the community to ask about the fence. Like, do they like it? Do they want it there? What would they like to see the park become? And what we found is that they do not like the fence. They want to fish there. They want to have access to the water. And so through those surveys, we were able to then work with Sarasota Bay Estuary Program to create a design that would enable a reasonable entry into the shoreline that would protect people who visit the park, but also provide access. And so the fence is coming down. You might have noticed that there's work starting there.
Wow.
Yeah, the fence is coming down and the shoreline is going to have the ability to access the water. There'll be some tiered steps, there'll be some living shoreline. And so some of the funding was from lawsuits in the area. So Suncoast Waterkeeper has been able to bring a few industries on the Myrtle Corridor and 301 to court, to federal court under the Clean Water Act. And we were able to secure settlement funds, which went to Sarasota Bay Estuary Program to work on the design of this project. And then Sarasota Bay Estuary Program was able to get other funds to actually do the work.
So Martin Luther King Park is on the southwest corner of Martin Luther King and Coconut, right?
Yeah.
And so we think of parks, I mean, maybe it's a stereotype, but we tend to think of creating parks as going out and finding an undeveloped place and purchasing it and, you know, putting in sidewalks or whatever. Martin Luther King Park was a neighborhood. It was a, there were streets in there and there were old wooden homes that were, you know, deteriorating under these big, gigantic oak trees. It was a really old neighborhood. And instead of having those homes that were, some of them, there on the water, instead of having those all torn down and putting in, you know, new mansions or whatever, that property was acquired and the homes were removed and it became a park. And I, now that you mentioned it, I remember the fence being there. I never thought to question, well, why, if you have a park on the water, why can't you interact with the water? That seems like a legitimate request. So
yeah, the community really brought this issue forward as being inequitable and,
yeah, yeah,
you know, worth questioning.
Well, that's so good. That's a great success story.
Yeah.
So talk about how one of the techniques that Suncoast Water uses is to sue people who are
misbehaving,
or who are sue governments who are allowing water quality to deteriorate, and then you negotiate a settlement with them to improve their facilities.
Yeah, so under the Clean Water Act, there's a provision called the Citizen Suits Provision, which allows you to bring polluters to federal court under the Clean Water Act. So basically, everybody gets a permit to pollute, and you have to abide by that permit. So we can bring people to federal court if they're not abiding by their permit, if they're exceeding the limits of their permit. Often we're finding that companies don't even have permits. So they're operating outside of the law. And so we can bring them to court to get them in compliance with the law. So our primary reason for doing this is to get companies in compliance with the law so that we are not overutilizing our water resources and we're protecting the quality. But then there's also cases where we do have to take government to court, and that's a little bit different. So it's still under the Clean Water Act. And so, like, for instance, Piney Point, we had to take the state of Florida to court over Piney Point because it was really the state of Florida that was negligent in protecting our water quality when it comes to Piney Point and adequately managing that area. And then, you know, as Water Keepers Florida, we've taken the state to court under the human health criteria. So basically, the state has to adopt human health criteria for water quality as it relates to the amount of toxins that are allowed in water related to fish consumption. So how much fish can we eat? What is the recommendation for fish consumption based on the amount of toxins found in our water? And that's supposed to be updated every 5 to 10 years. And it hasn't been updated at all since its initial rendition. I don't know what else to call it.
Inception.
So, yeah. Inception, yeah. So we have taken the state to court over this issue, and we are waiting to have them fix the problem. So in that case, there won't be any settlement funds. We're just wanting them to fix the problem and come up with human health criteria for fish consumption. In the case of Piney Point, there was a settlement, and that was really regarding money to monitor the destruction of Tampa Bay as a result of the Piney Point discharges. And then they also had to stick to a monitoring schedule that would actually have limits to the amount of pollution that could be discharged through Piney Point. Before we got involved, they were going to allow for any discharge of pollution, and all they had to do was record it and send it to the state. They didn't have any limits. And so with our involvement, we were able to get limits on the permit before they closed Piney Point, so as they were closing. Now, for these industries on Myrtle, or for the city of Bradenton or Sarasota County, which we've also sued for pollution regarding sewage, those settlements, none of it comes back to Suncoast Waterkeeper. It's a negotiation between parties, and it's figuring out who can receive funds to do an environmentally beneficial project. So the project is supposed to enhance water quality in the area where there was damage done by the pollution itself. And so figuring out who is the person or the organization — there's not any individual, it's always an organization — that can take these funds and do the project is what has been a challenge. But we've worked with a lot of great partners. For instance, in the city of Bradenton, settlement money has gone to Oyster River Ecology to put oysters in Manatee River, because Manatee River used to be called the Oyster River, and that is where the pollution has been going. So when the city of Bradenton doesn't abide by their permit, it sends polluted wastewater into Manatee River. So that's the place where we need to concentrate on environmentally beneficial projects. So that's one example. Sarasota Bay Estuary Program received settlement money from just about every industry that we have sued under the Clean Water Act, which went to MLK Park. And then Tampa Bay Estuary Program has received a bunch of settlement money to do. They have a program where they subgrant money for projects, and projects that really fit the scope of the settlement are able to be funded by some of the settlement fees. So,
and now, is that a restitution fund? I'm asking because at one point I was on a board or panel that would receive proposals like that, where somebody had done something wrong, they're forced to pay money to the government into this restitution fund, and then those dollars were supposed to be spent to improve something somewhere, and I had to go through and review projects and score them, and then eventually I just stopped hearing from them, so I don't know whatever happened to that.
I've never heard it called that.
Okay.
It is a settlement that is, it's called Stipulated Environmental Penalties, or we call them SEPs for short, but basically they are the environmental penalties that a polluter has to pay in order to fix the problem. So not only do they have to, like for the case of the industries on Myrtle or on 301, they had to clean up first their stormwater. So that's primary, right? You got to clean up your stormwater so you're no longer discharging polluted stormwater. And then beyond that, though, what do you have to do to fix the environment to hopefully right the wrong that has been done by your pollution? And so that is a supplemental environmental project, and that is done by these agreed to organizations who can do this work, because the industry can't do the work and we're not allowed to accept the money. So it has to be a third party who can actually do the work, and it has to be a nonprofit.
So here's a question. So far in the show, we've heard about reasons you might not want to swim in the water. You might not want to drink the water. You might not want to eat the fish. How does Suncoast Waterkeeper get funded if you're not getting money from these legal challenges and there's so much work to be done? What is your business model? How does that all get paid for?
Yeah, so we get money through individual donors. So we have a membership program where it's just $25 a year to become a member. So we have lots of members and people are very generous. But then we also get a lot of foundation grants. So local foundations provide grants to go towards specific programs. None of them are for our lawsuits, though. So people who, individuals have really been stepping up for our legal fund, and we're going to be stepping up our legal fund this year in order to rise to this year's challenges.
Incredible. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we're also creating a business partnership program. It's in order to work with local businesses that rely on clean water for their business. We are working to engage them in having clean water be one of their goals.
Yeah. Yep. So you have an office in the Resilience Center?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have an office at the Resilience Incubator, which is located on the second floor of the Suncoast Blood Center on Mound Street.
Right.
And so we occupy that space with about 9 other environmental groups.
You've been listening to our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton, or listen online.
Today's show, number 79, featured Suncoast Waterkeeper's Executive Director, Abby Turna.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archive. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment.
Tune in at 9 next week for the Healthy Living Hour with Dr. Rebecca Acosta.
And tune at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on February 17th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street here in Sarasota.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and performed by John Lambie.